Getting primaried has become a dreaded verb in politics. This hour, the intra-party rivalry and the debilitating partisan rancor in Washington through the eyes of former U.S. Congressman Jim Leach. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Jim Leach served Iowa for 30 years as a member of the U.S. House of Representatives. We'll get his insights on how the current political climate became so dysfunctional and what's needed to improve it. Also, our regular political analyst, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, is with us to share his thoughts. Join our discussion for this Politics Wednesday. It starts right after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and Politics Wednesday is once again upon us, and time for us to reflect on recent politics. Joining us in our Ames studio, Jim McCormick is with us, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Iowa State University. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, and we have a special guest for this edition of Politics Wednesday on River to River. Jim Leach is with us. Congressman Leach served 15 terms, 30 years, from 1977 to 2007 as a Republican member of the United States House of Representatives, representing Iowa. He is currently a University of Iowa visiting law professor. Congressman Leach, welcome to you.
Well, I'm happy to be with you, and pleased to be with you as well, Jim.
Thank you. Happy to be with you, Congressman.
As we promoted it, the show of Jims today. And if you'd like to join our questions, your questions for Congressman Leach or our analyst, Jim McCormick, please join in our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, our email. We're also on Facebook, or you can send us a message, a tweet at IPR Talk. Congressman Leach, you had led a discussion this week in Coralville during which you shared some of your thoughts about the current political climate, related matters, the problems that Jim and I and other analysts have discussed week in and week out throughout the years in recent years, the dysfunction in Washington. And I'd like to hear how you characterize the current political climate.
Well, it's amazing how many citizens, if you talk to, if the word Congress comes up, within 5 or 10 seconds, the person you mention the word Congress to comes out with the word dysfunctional, which is a widespread view. It's not totally dysfunctional, but many of the processes have broken down, and the attitudes are of a nature that I've never seen before in public life. Now, we all know historically that there have been worse periods in American history, the decade before the Civil War, for instance. But there were reasons for that terrifying division that existed. I mean, slavery was a profound issue. We know in the early part of the 19th century, Thomas Jefferson hired a journalist that called John Adams a hermaphrodite. You have to go to a dictionary to figure out if that's a terrifyingly awful characterization or not. But today we have words that have gotten out of hand. We've got attitudes that have gotten out of hand. And I sometimes like to say that when I entered politics, I used to make one-to-one analogies between sports and politics. By the time I left the Congress at the invitation of my constituents, which my family thoroughly thought had made the correct choice and judgment, but sports came to stand for vastly higher ethics than politics, and partly because sports have referees, partly you hire coaches that teach kids to respect the opponent. In politics, the coaches are political advisors who teach every candidate in a close election to, quote, go negative. And so you have a ethic of politics that is just of a very different nature than needs to be the case. And that doesn't mean absolutely worse than any other period. It doesn't mean that there aren't analogies in other periods in history, but this is a circumstance that is really tragic for the country.
I know you have strong opinions about the 2010 Citizens United decision in which the U.S. Supreme Court held that the First Amendment prohibits the government from restricting political independence. We also have a somewhat related case before the Supreme Court now. It has to do with aggregate limits on donations, the amount of money an individual can donate during an election cycle. Tell us how you see money and the campaign financing feeding into the dysfunction that you've just described and the attitudes.
Well, money is a huge ingredient into the decision-making of individuals in politics, and no one likes to admit it. It's noted that both parties advise all incumbents to spend 1 to 2 days a week fundraising. But what does that mean? And it means that people get indebted to groups and people that provide money in the process. The Citizens United ruling, which is opens the floodgates to corporate contributions and moves America in a corporatist rather than a democratic direction. It is, in my view, the second worst decision in the history of the Supreme Court. The worst decision that will never be matched in all probability was the Dred Scott ruling, where the court held that a class of individuals, those of color, could be considered property that could be bought and sold.
And returned to a slave state.
And, well, maintain a slave state in that instance. Mm-hmm. Citizens United, they have an inverse logic. They call a class of property that is corporations human beings. And the only way you can get to the ruling in Citizens United is if you assume that a corporation is an individual and if you assume that money is speech. And therefore, if you make those two assumptions, under the First Amendment, you cannot curtail free speech. Well, I don't know any dictionary that calls a corporation an individual. I don't know of any dictionary that calls money speech. And this is a absolutely preposterous ruling that is changing the DNA of American politics. And I think the country ought to stand on its collective legs and demand change.
Jim McCormick, along those lines, your reflections or perhaps a question yourself for the congressman?
Well, I was just wondering, one of the arguments that's sometimes made is that the interactions between members of Congress has really changed. And, given your long service there, did you interact with lots of other members of Congress? You know, the complaint is that members of Congress now are there for, Tuesday through Thursday, and they're back in their districts, and there's no familiarity with members either, even within their own parties, but certainly across the aisle. Did you sense that?
There has been a profound change, and it sounds strange to talk about the chemistry of Congress as contrasted with the issues of Congress. But it is a valid observation. And when I entered the United States Congress, at least half my friends were on the Democratic side, and one socialized with them and got to know wives and family, and that leads to one set of attitudes. If you look at the history of the 20th century and you read about how Congress dealt with each other, it's really intriguing that there was a 436th member of the Congress in the first part of the century, and that 436th member was a man named Jack Daniels. And there was an awful lot of interchanges with Jack. And I sometimes joke to my friends that maybe they ought to reelect Jack. But in any regard, the people today interface with each other principally in caucuses. And these caucuses mean all Republicans meet in a room, all Democrats meet in a room, and they have the effect of coalescing around each other. And in coalescing around each other, a continual diatribe against the other people in the other room. And the attitudes are really, really stark. And what you see in debate in the House floor is trivial compared to what you hear in the cloakrooms and in the caucuses.
Not so in your day in the late 70s when you were first elected?
Things began to change in the very late 70s and early 80s on the Republican side and, frankly, surrounding the election of Newt Gingrich, who was a very smart and very organization-centric member who argued that the Republicans could never regain control unless they got more organized in a rather partisan way against the opposition. He might have had some truth in his observations, but things started to change in a very gradualist nature. And so this has been step by step by step. But philosophers will tell you sometimes that a difference in degree can at some point become a difference in kind. And that is actually what has occurred. All of a sudden, we have seen what were gradual increases in unforgiving partisanship becoming the order of the day.
And you represented, you were often termed a moderate Republican, and you represented Iowa for 30 years there. Do you think such a Republican could be elected in Iowa or other parts of the country these days? Were you to be a young man today and had those aspirations with your views, where would you find a home?
Well, let me say there are two elections, and people often forget about it. The great weakness in the American democratic system today is the primary, where there is very small levels of participation. A moderate has virtually no chance in either the Democratic or Republican primary to prevail, although a moderate in a general election might have a credible chance of prevailing. Unless that is third or fourth party movements develop in significant ways. And so one of the calculations, for instance, if you look at the next presidential election, is that the Republicans might want to have a Libertarian on the ticket in order to decline the prospect of a serious Libertarian candidate as fourth party. There have been times that a fourth party or third party has made a difference in the Democratic side. The 2,000 votes that Ralph Nader received in Florida and probably swung the election to George W. Bush over Al Gore. I mean, so new parties can make a difference. They can also energize the process. But these are very interesting calculations that the parties are making.
Jim Leach is with us, former GOP member of the House of Representatives, served Iowa forever. Represented Iowa for over 30 years in Congress. Jim McCormick with us as well, one of our old hands as far as political analysts go on Wednesday. We invite you to join our conversation with your questions, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Let's go to Shirley. Shirley is joining us from Monticello.
Hello.
Hi, Shirley. Welcome to our program.
Thank you very much. Representative Leach, I voted for you for all these years. I think you're a very scrupulous man, and I think you're very intelligent. And the point that I like to know, this is, don't you agree this is the divided states of America?
Well, that's a very strong term, but we are certainly more divided than we've ever been. But I would hesitate to quite use that term, but I, as a hyperbole, I sense very much what you're saying.
Yeah, so the Tea Party, what has this Tea Party got to have to do with, it's like when Ireland had their fight against the English, how the Fenn brothers went against the English people?
Well, that's an interesting analogy. It's a little extreme because we're not using arms against each other. Let me first give some sympathy to the Tea Party in the sense that if you look at what's happened in the last decade, we've been in our two longest and most debilitating wars. We've had an unneeded recession and a tepid recovery. And these caused a lot of people to be very concerned about how public decision-making is being made and what decisions have gone along with that decision-making. And so there's reason for the public to be disenchanted. Now, whether one agrees with everything the Tea Party stands for is another matter, but it's certainly understandable why there is a lot of concern in the public.
Thank you, Shirley, for joining our conversation. I wanted to address what has been on the minds of many people these last few weeks, also concerning politics, the Affordable Care Act, the rollout of what is commonly called Obamacare. And Jim McCormick, catch us up to speed on where we are right now. We've had a series of, well, two problems with the president's rollout of his signature health care law. Remind us what those are.
Well, the website has been, sort of the first issue that came on board. You know, the website was opened up on October 1st and found to be dysfunctional. I think even at today there's testimony by one of the IT people that's responsible for bringing it up to speed, hoping that November 30th will be the completion date. I suppose the other notion that you're referring to was the commitment that the president made that those that have their health insurance would be able to keep it, and sort of the latest kind of glitch on that is that former President Clinton came out, I guess, in an interview and said that the president ought to live up to that commitment, further exacerbating the kind of debate that we see.
In fact, Jim, we have a little tape of that in an interview with Aussie.com. Former President Clinton outlined a few problems he sees with the rollout of Obamacare, one of which Clinton thinks can be fixed by the Obama administration.
Third problem is for young people, mostly, but not all young, who are in the individual market whose incomes are above 400% of the poverty level. They were the ones who heard the promise, if you like what you got, you can keep it. I met a young man just this week who has a family, two children, bought in the individual marketplace. His policy was canceled and one was substituted for it that doubled his premium. Now, I asked him, I said, same coverage? He said, yeah. And I said, but are your co-pays and deductibles the same? He said, no, they're much, much lower. So he said, in the years when I use health care, I might actually save money. But he said, we're all young and we're all healthy. So I personally believe, even if it takes a change in the law, the president should honor the commitment the federal government made to those people and let them keep what they got.
Bill Clinton, in an interview with Aussie.com, an interesting reaction to that idea from former Vice President Dick Cheney, this on Fox News.
I'm inclined to agree with Bill Clinton that's something that ought to be attempted. But given the complexity of the system, and you've already got people now who've lost their policies, who can't get new ones, these policies have been declared by law to be inadequate because of the standards that are written into the federal regulations.
Okay. Congressman Leach, your reflections on this. Should the president keep the promise he seems to have made that people with their own plans should be able to keep them?
Well, that would be certainly a preferable circumstance. I'm listening to this with real interest. A former president is divorcing for his wife's sake from a particular issue. A former vice president is suggesting that great inadequacy exists. And so this is a wonderful review. Now, they both have a point that has a certain degree of validity to it. And so you can't exactly disagree with either of them. Mm-hmm. This is American politics at its most subtle.
And you are reading right between the lines in those two things. Bill Clinton, you're saying he's got 2016 in mind for his wife, and
well, that's understandable and quite reasonable. And his wife is the enormous favorite for the Democratic primary. Now, that may all change in the next year or two, but she is the greatest frontrunner I have ever seen in my political life at this stage for a party's nomination.
Having been worked within the culture in Washington, D.C., that political culture for three decades, what are your thoughts, Jim Leach, on how this acknowledged so technology-obsessed White House, when we think back to the Obama campaign in 2008, failed to head off this technological disaster that was the launch of the health insurance exchanges?
Well, the irony is very large in that because this is a technology-centric White House. And it's what happens in government. Presidents devolve accountability in many ways, and it's understandable that a president might not have thought a lot about a website 6 months ago. Today, I'm confident every single person in the White House is talking website every minute of the day. And it's just one of those things. It's a true embarrassment. But people shouldn't lose sight that the real issues are what the substance of the health care reform is, and that this presumably as a website is going to get fixed sometime in the next 2, 3, 4 months. Whether it's by the end of this month, I don't know. But at some point, the website will be fixed. The question then becomes whether the substance of the reform is acceptable to the American people or not.
And does that hang in the balance, in your opinion?
To some degree. I went through, as a member of Congress, one circumstance that I thought one of the most common sense reforms ever in healthcare was inaugurated. And a year later, it was revoked. And this was under President Reagan, we passed a catastrophic healthcare bill. But in passing it, we also passed a way of paying for it. And the people that had to pay for it objected strenuously, particularly the elderly. Mm-hmm. And a year later, Congress actually pulled the plug. So those things happened. Now, in this case, clearly the dissenters to it want a delay because they feel once it's put in place, it will be hard to retract. And that's going to be very interesting to see whether it's possible or not. If you have a change in parties, virtually everyone in the opposition party, the Republicans, has committed to repealing. And so it is possible. But I would be surprised if there is a repeal that they don't have to keep many elements of it in under different terms and different contexts. But who knows?
Jim McCormick, we have about a minute before break. How do you see that? Has the Rubicon been crossed? When does the fight give up on the part of the Republicans to repeal Obamacare?
I think the issue will be how many people sign up once the website gets up and running. I mean, it was even alluded to in that clip that you had in terms of young people, will they sign up? I mean, you know, they are going to be the drivers of it, they are going to be the paymasters of it in many ways. So I think the sign-up issue, and you've already seen that in terms of opposition, you know, talking about how many people have signed up. And I think after November 30th, after the website is officially functioning, if you will, and the White House says it's functioning, then we'll see how many people sign up. That's the Rubicon that I would see.
Okay, Jim McCormick is with us of Iowa State University. Jim Leach is with us as our special guest, former GOP member of the House of Representatives, served Iowa for 30 years in Washington, talking about, well, many things, the ACA, dysfunction in Congress, what's at the root of it, and perhaps in our second half hour we can get the congressman's views on how to get out of what many perceive as a mess and dysfunction. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Join our conversation at 1-866-780-9100. Back with more Politics Wednesday after a short break. Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Wednesday, a time when we look over our political landscape and do some analysis. Jim McCormick is with us of Iowa State University. Often here on Politics Wednesday, we have a special guest. Jim Leach is with us in our Iowa City studios. Former member of the House of Representatives, served Iowa in Washington for 30 years, from 1977 to 2007. Currently, a University of Iowa visiting law professor. We are watching, gentlemen, both Congress and President Obama continue to sink in the polls. We're talking about dysfunction in Washington, among other things. Also, the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, its rollout. Quinnipiac survey released yesterday found that President Obama's approval rating dropping to 39%, the lowest point in that poll. 44% said the president was honest and trustworthy. That's an all-time low for him compared to the 52% who disagreed. Meanwhile, the Gallup poll, when we look at Congress, showed their approval rating, Congress's rating, declined to a mere 9%. That's the lowest mark in the Gallup poll's 39 history of asking that question. Jim McCormick, let me start off with you. How important are polls?
Well, I think they're what they do is create an atmosphere in which the government operates or which the president operates. And I mean, the congressman can speak to this, but my limited experience working in Congress for a short time was that members actually monitor the polls. I don't know if they monitor the 9%, you know, number, but they monitor on the public sentiment on particular issues here. And when the president has a low approval rating, that actually, I think, does have an impact on the kind of attitude they might take on particular issues. So I don't think they're irrelevant. The 9%, you know, is often juxtaposed against how much we love our own member of Congress. So the own member of Congress usually mm-hmm. does much, much better than the sort of aggregate measure of the Congress as a whole.
Congressman Leach, how much did you pay attention to polls like this, the entire Congress approval, disapproval, or did you really just look at whether your constituents were happy with your work?
Well, actually, neither. In my time in public life, I only did three or four polls over 30 years. Now, you do note polls, but no poll ever affected how I looked at a president's initiative or not. But Jim is 100% correct that attitudinally they do set a framework. A popular, strong president has advantages in dealing with the United States Congress. And if Congress has an initiative that's popular, they have an advantage dealing with the White House. But I've never particularly noted the second happening very much. Teddy Roosevelt used to talk about a bully pulpit. Presidents have that. Congress has a limited pulpit, but in aggregate, it can be large too. And that's one reason why both political parties have talking points on presidential speeches. Both political parties have talking points when members return to their districts about what they think should be talked about in what kind of way to advance their party's interest.
Let's go to our phones. Plenty of listeners with comments or questions. John is in Waterloo. Hi, John.
Hi. I may be off the point here for today, but has Congressman Leach addressed how he got drawn into the Graham-Leach-Biley legislation and then the subsequent Sarbanes-Oxley and Dodd-Frank, what he is thinks about that? Is that somewhere else that maybe I shouldn't take up time here for?
No, John, I think that's fair game. John in Waterloo, Congressman Leach, sponsor of the 1999 Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, I think considered one of the seminal pieces of banking legislation in the 20th century.
And one of the most misunderstood.
Okay, so okay. Explain
first
that.
Let me explain what the act did and didn't do. One, it didn't repeal what's called Glass-Steagall. What it did was modify what's called Glass-Steagall. And all it did was change the competitive relationships between various financial kinds of companies so that a commercial bank could do investment banking, an investment bank could do commercial banking, and insurance could do both, and they could all do insurance. The regulatory framework, however, has been surprisingly stable for the last three quarters of a century. And in these mixed activities, if a commercial bank did investment banking, it comes under the – it's a separate part of the financial company and it gets regulated by securities regulators. If a securities company does a commercial bank activity, it gets regulated by commercial bank regulators. Now, the reason I mention this is The great change that occurred in the last decade and a half was in the – not the competitive change, but the decision of regulators to – at the federal level but not the state level – to lower what are called leverage ratios and – well, actually lower the capital needed so that you have higher leverage ratios. And so what occurred was while Iowa banks were required by state regulators to keep 8 to 12% capital relative to deposits, the New York and the large financial institutions were allowed to skinny their capital down to 2 or 3%. Mm-hmm. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac actually got to be less than 1%. And these were the what caused the great over-leveraging. But in terms of economic activity that caused this great recession, it was principally that of a real estate loss of value and a series of processes by which real estate loans were packaged and resold. And in this regard, there is no activity that New York financial institutions dealt with that got them in difficulty that couldn't have been done before the reform of Glass-Steagall. Banks could always do mortgage products. They could always do derivatives products. And so none of these activities related to the competitive changes that occurred in Glass-Steagall. Mm-hmm. Now, I will tell you the good news in banking is that banks now have higher levels of capital at the money center level than they did before the problem. The bad news, and it is really worrisome, is that what are called derivatives contracts have mushroomed. The GDP of the United States is, let's say, $18, $19 trillion. The total value of derivatives contracts existence are now $600 trillion. That is vastly greater than the GDP of the United States, vastly greater than the GDP of all countries in the world combined. And what that means is that the market has become one not just of performing a service for a commercial company to reduce risk, it has become a casino. And this derivative circumstance, Warren Buffett calls derivatives basically economic instruments of potential mass destruction, and he's exactly right. Now, he's frankly runs a business that takes advantage of derivatives. By the same token, this is a really dangerous circumstance in the world, and I do not think derivatives are properly regulated at all.
Let's go to a caller, Shannon. Shannon joining us from Davenport. Hi, Shannon. Welcome to River with Jim Leach and Jim McCormick.
Hi. My question is actually somewhat related to the polls. Just as there was wide public support for very stringent increasing the background checks for gun ownership, that was ignored by legislators, even though it had huge public support. Another issue for me is public campaign finance reform, which again has pretty wide public support and even verbal support from a lot of legislators, but it doesn't seem that it's actually going to get passed since they would be the ones affected by it.
Right.
Are there any other legal mechanisms or pathways, or do we just have to have, you know, a revolution by the people to get that done?
Right, Shannon, good point. The system that we have now is the system that put the people in elected office that we have now. So is it realistic, Jim McCormick, to expect that they would engage in campaign finance reform? And how much stress do they have to experience pressure from their constituents to do that?
I don't think it's realistic to expect that. I mean, as the congressman talked in the sort of the first portion of this program, that, you know, if the instruction is to spend 1 to 2 days a week, you know, raising campaign funds for the next, you know, election. And particularly if you couple that with the notion of the primary here, where they're going to get this vocal minority to really challenge them if they were to change their position, whether it be on gun control or on campaign financing. I think those are big, very big hurdles to get members of Congress to move away from.
Mm-hmm. Address Shannon's point there, Congressman Leach.
Well, let me talk a little bit about campaign reform. The irony is that it's the one point where I think the Tea Party and stark liberals should reach agreement. The Tea Party and stark liberals both have concluded that the United States Congress has become less indebted to individual constituencies and more indebted to big, powerful interests. And there is no reason why there shouldn't be a mutual effort from all political spectrums to look at this issue as one of sheer democracy. Now, the difficulty is not simply can Congress get its act together, but the traditional moderating institution in America is the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court has taken the position that this is a First Amendment issue, which means that almost any law that could be passed would be ruled unconstitutional. And so the only thing that can happen is you need either a constitutional amendment or you need a change in the court. Now, this decision was 5-4, and one can visualize a change. Whether or not that occurs, I don't know. Now, a change can occur if a member of the court decides that they had misdecided. Now, that is an unlikely prospect, but not inconceivable. It's also possible that you have members that leave the court for whatever reason and are replaced by members with a different judgment.
Jim Leach with us, along with Jim McCormick, 1-866-780-9100, finishing up Politics Wednesday. We have another 10 minutes or so. We'll try to get in as many of your questions and comments. Stan from Urbandale, welcome to our program.
Hi.
Hi.
I think my question would probably be for Jim Leach, but really maybe any on the panel. You know, of course, there's a lot of weeping and gnashing of teeth in the mainstream Republican Party over the their candidates getting primaried. And I'm wondering if any of the panelists are aware of perhaps a desire to change gerrymandered districts after the next census so that they become more like regular districts to hopefully prevent some of that in the future.
Stan, thank you for that question from Urbandale. Iowa, a model there of nonpartisan redistricting, and we just had that in the last census, Congressman Leach. Do you see any chance of other states following our lead?
Well, Iowa is the strongest model in the country, partly because it has a feature that people don't note very much, and that's a constitutional feature that you cannot break up counties in congressional redistricting. And what that means is that with each decennial census, as people look at the makeup of the state, to get the least deviation in numbers between districts, you have to move counties a lot. And so every time there's a redistricting, there is more movement in Iowa than any other state. Now, having said that, there are some California's moved a bit to an Iowa model. They have a nonpartisan commission that recommends redistricting. And other states are considering it. But for partisan reasons, the majority party in every state is told, don't play that game, the nonpartisan game, because we want you to make sure that your party or our party has the upper hand. Now, I will say there is some of the districts that are strongly one party. A lot of them are quite natural. I mean, it's pretty hard to carve out a Republican district in inner city Chicago. But redistricting is often the art of putting all of the other party concentrated in one area so that you can have other areas that might be 55% your party. And these games are played by Republicans in Texas and historically by Democrats in states like California, although California has reformed.
Comment on that, Jim McCormick, or shall we move on?
Well, I think I agree entirely with the congressman. It's really hard politically for these, state legislatures, if that's the mode usually, to go against their own party.
Mm-hmm. Congressman Leach.
And by the way, there's one other aspect to it. Everyone abstractly knows that redistricting is exceptionally important, but I have found that redistricting is about as interesting to the public as somebody else's genealogy.
Not very interesting. We're finishing up the hour here. Congressman Leach, in 2008, we're reminded that you spoke at the Democratic National Convention when then-Senator Barack Obama was nominated. You also highlighted the important historical moments from previous Republican and Democratic presidents in that speech. You reiterated your endorsement of President Obama. And in a couple of lines that I have noted here stand out for me. A line like this, which could be spoken today: political and economic standing has been diminished. Our nation's leadership is not reflected in partisan bickering. No change there. You said that you were proud of the Republican contribution to American history, but also proud of the judgment of Democrats in nominating a transcending candidate who will recapture the American dream and be a truly great president. Now, has Barack Obama been the transcending figure you had hoped for?
Well, I think everybody looks at presidents with positive and skeptical appraisals. My view is you have to look at relative circumstances. And the relative circumstance I was looking at was in 2008 was the worst foreign policy judgmentally in American history. And I believed we desperately needed a change in that foreign policy.
After 8 years of George W. Bush.
Yeah, that is correct. And I, as a person, I liked President Bush very much. As a policymaker in foreign affairs, I was very disappointed. In this presidency, you've seen an effort to change foreign policy. It hasn't gone quite as far as maybe I thought it might. But I will tell you, relative to the alternatives, it's been a constructive change. But we are in a deep morass in the Muslim world, and we have to work our way out of it. Now, we've largely ended the war in Iraq, but it's been we still maintain troops in Iraq. I don't know how wise that is or isn't. I personally am skeptical. We are now preceding the end of the war in Afghanistan. I might have hoped it'd be quicker.
Mm-hmm.
I would hope we'd have some change in positions on Cuba. I mean, the idea of this embargo is counterproductive, in my view, very profoundly. Other parts of the world, I think the president has been quite credible.
Is President Obama on track to becoming a truly great president, as you predicted in that 2008 speech?
I think he will go down as one of the most interesting presidents in American history, and is one that symbolizes the difficulty of circumstance, that there are certain analogies to Herbert Hoover. That is, Hoover was one of the most profoundly decent, great men conceivable to run for the office, and yet the circumstances were overwhelming. In this president's case, other than Herbert Hoover, no one has been dealt a worse hand. Now, maybe arguably Lincoln as well. And in dealing with one of the most difficult circumstances ever, the president comes up, in my judgment, of doing a better job than many people perceive. It is a sterling achievement to have stabilized the economy.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as good as we all hope, because we'd like to have a booming economy. But it could have been far worse.
So the answer to the truly great president question is?
Quite possible.
Quite possible. Still possible. Jim McCormick, we have one last question for you. Jim Leach, you're still a Republican?
Yes, sir.
Jim McCormick, we're finishing up the hour. You have thoughts to finish up the hour?
Well, I just wanted to maybe add a comment to what the congressman mentioned here. You know, certainly what President Obama has brought is in terms of recapturing some of the reputation of the United States around the world, and you know, the kind of acceptance of the U.S. But the real area that he also highlighted, I just like to punctuate as well, and that is in the Muslim world. You know, we had the Cairo speech back in 2009, reaching out to the Muslim world. But if you look at all of the kind of survey that have been done in terms of the Muslim world compared to other areas of the world, that's the one area where the president has not been able to have a breakthrough in terms of reputation. I mean, we didn't get to, but I mean, there are obviously some real problems in the Middle East at the moment in the Muslim world, and in terms of Iran and Syria and the whole Arab Spring, and that certainly has contributed to it in another way, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But that's sort of one area that I see some disappointment in.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to make one bipartisan observation.
Congressman, we have about 30 or 40 seconds,
well,
but please.
Be very quick. In Africa, we assume the president would do well, and he has. But so did George W. Bush. And one of the great things that happened a few months back, they were in Africa together, and both were well received, and deservedly so.
Wanted to just finish up by asking you how you are liking your visiting professorship at the University of Iowa. How does it feel to be back in the classroom among young people?
Well, it couldn't have been a better thing for me personally. Whether the students approve that, you have to ask them.
Okay, Jim Leach, thank you so much for coming in. Former member of the House of Representatives, Jim Leach, now University of Iowa visiting law professor. We appreciate your time, sir.
Well, thank you.
And, sir, we appreciate your time as well, Jim McCormick.
Thank you very much.
At our Ames studio, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Iowa State University. Thank you for your calls, emails, tweets this hour. Listeners, so sorry we didn't get to all of them, but there's always another Politics Wednesday next week. Tomorrow on this program, we'll look at Iowa's Filipino community, their reaction over the superstorm that has killed so many in the Philippines. What can be done to aid the recovery? That's tomorrow on our program. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Technical support from Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins in Ames. Help from Jason Burns and Garrett Van Leeuwen. Our theme music written and performed by the River Monks. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.